Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Some interesting questions coming in here with regards to Vladimir Tarasenko, cap recapture penalties, which I'm not sure everybody knows this. I think most hockey fans do, Karen, that when the new CBA got put together, they changed the way that's going to work. There was the possibility that existed at one point that if Shea Weber had retired in a specific year, that Nashville could be stung for $24 million on the cap in one particular year. The league was never going to allow that to happen. That will further frustrate fans in Vancouver dealing with a Roberto Luongo cap recapture penalty with a contract that was signed under rules that were completely legal at the time, and the NHL retroactively chose to punish the Vancouver Canucks and the Roberto Luongo contract if what in fact did happen eventually happened. But we don't need to go down that rabbit hole again today. They changed it so that it would be AAV as opposed to we're going to look at each particular year.
Okay, so Minnesota's not on the hook for anything. That's what you're telling me? Like, there's no cap recapture with this one? Or is there? You don't know.
It just works differently. It just works differently. So the reason Roberto Luongo's cap hit was what it was is because of the year Luongo retired, and the year would change it. And basically, without getting into too much technicality, let's say Shea Weber retired. Well, Nashville could get hit with a cap recapture penalty, but it wouldn't fluctuate year after year. This is different than buyouts. We're seeing that with the specific contracts involved with Parise and Suter, which are going to be bought out by the Minnesota Wild. But it would be applied on an AAV. So Nashville would have a cap recapture penalty, but it would be an AAV hit per year as opposed to, well, right, here you go, you're going to have $24 million in this particular year.
Okay, I think I've got it. What we know is that Bill Guerin decided to make a bold move today. He wants to change his team, and two guys that were brought in 8 years ago at the cost of, was it $192 million? Is that what I saw combined? Talking about coming home, American players going to, you know, Minnesota where they love their hockey, and in the end, it didn't work out, and Bill Guerin says, you know what, you two? I'm going a different direction with this team, and we need to sign some of our younger players, more important players. We're still going to pay you $6-some-odd million to not be on our roster for the next however many seasons. That's what I got.
Yeah, Bill Guerin's going to be talking to every single league source he has to try to maximize revenue for the league over the next 2 or 3 years so that the cap goes up by the time they really get stung.
That's what I saw on Twitter. It's like, does Bill Guerin have some inside information about the cap going up that we don't know about or other GMs don't know about? Elliot Friedman's been on record as saying multiple GMs have told him that he thinks for the next 5 years it's going to be a flat cap. And if that's the case, then Bill Guerin might be a little screwed going forward. But if somehow he has some information and the cap goes up and, you know, we have no idea what revenue is going to be like over the next couple of years, hey, he may look good down the road.
We also were talking about the Vladimir Tarasenko situation. We got this question coming in from Rager. Do you think there's a path for St. Louis to entice Seattle by offering their assets to take Tarasenko in the expansion draft? Yes, there is. And we saw this play out with Vegas, and it's different. But yeah, there's a path there. And if you're creative in your Seattle, this is the great asset you have right now. So let's say you're Seattle and St. Louis can't find a trading partner and says, do you want the player? Well, we'll take the player. We don't like the cap hit. We don't like the amount of money we have to pay out. What are you going to give us? I don't know what that asset is that St. Louis is willing to pony up if they are that if it's that desirable to get out from under that contract for the next 2 years. But let's say you get something. Name your pick. Second round pick, third round pick. We'll give it to you. We just want this off the books. Then you turn around if you're Seattle and you look at another team and you say, here's what we're willing to do for you. We'll retain money on this for the next couple of years. You take the player. He can help you out. And the acquiring team says, that sounds pretty good, actually. We like Vladimir Tarasenko and the risks associated with him. We just don't like it at that cap number. Okay, here's another asset. You can stockpile. Like, there's a way to do this, and we saw Vegas exercise a lot of this. We saw them load up on defensemen and then sell a bunch of those defensemen off. Mark Mathot is one of the good examples of that. Took him out of Ottawa. Whoa, that's a great pick. Next thing you know, he was in Dallas, and they had more assets. It speaks to your greater plan. It speaks to how creative you want to be. So, yes, there is a path to this happening. I just don't know that it's going to necessarily.
And what we've heard is the fact that, yes, Ron Francis is busy and has been busy for months and months. But here's the thing. Ron Francis wants to do this his way, and he wants to be in control of this from all the reports out there. Like, he is not going to help any franchises out. He's like, I'm starting a new franchise. I don't know if I can have the success of Vegas. We don't know if he's going to build a team like Vegas did. But you know what he's not going to do? He's not going to help out cap-strapped teams. He's going to say, you're going to have to help me out. You are going to have to give me more, probably, than what you were hoping for if I'm going to take a player and have to take on salary. It just strikes me as Ron Francis is going to be a very crude negotiator with some of these general managers because he knows how much against the cap they are. He knows the flat cap's issue with how many teams in this NHL. I think it's... somehow 15 teams or something like that are over the cap right now. So it's like, it's, he's at the benefit. He's has the advantage right now. And from everything that we've heard, it's like, he's going to play hardball and he's going to play hardball till he gets what he wants.
And the clock is ticking for teams to get those expansion lists together and player movement gets frozen as of Saturday. Can you get something done in the next few days? As hockey fans, we are hopeful we're going to see some more activity and we're going to see some more things like what happened today with Parise and Suter that we didn't expect to see coming. It's Rintoul and Sermon. We promised you the Stephen Brunt clip. I want to get to it. Training camps are going on around the CFL right now. And for the most part around this country, there's optimism because the league is going to play this year. But that doesn't mean there's optimism about the entire future of the league. Now, Stephen Brunt was on in Calgary today, and he was having a conversation with Ryan Pinder, and it turned into a bit of a debate about where Toronto fits in the CFL picture. And part of the premise was, look, do you really need the Toronto Argonauts? If it's not going to work in that market, do you have to be there? And here's what Stephen Brunt had to say.
Right. It's not what I think and you think that matters. It's what the guys who are actually paying the bills and losing, what, $12 million last year on the Toronto Argonauts. They get a vote here.
For sure.
And yeah. So, and there's no other them, I would argue. There is no one else who would own that team under the current circumstances. And I've seen that team go through, believe me, I've seen them try everything, you know, in terms of how to promote the product. I've seen all kinds of different ownership structures. I've seen David Braley as the, you know, the phantom owner behind Cinnamon and Sokolowski when mm-hmm. he was actually paying the bills. I saw Ron Barbaro try to build a community ownership structure after McNall walked away. You know, Sherwood Schwartz, a guy who kind of, you know, went and spent the kid's inheritance and before they dragged him away. I've seen everything. And remember, TSN owned the team, right? Like they walked in and owned it all by themselves at one point. So a lot of people have tried and they tried a bunch of different things. And the biggest sports entertainment company in the country right now, which is Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, right now is, you know, again, throwing up its hands and saying, we can't do this anymore the same way. And we are looking for something different.
Okay, so there's a bunch there. We can't do this the same way. We're looking for something different. And the argument, and Donovan Bennett laid this out earlier in the program, and Stephen Brunt talked about this in the further conversation with Ryan Pinder and Matt Rose this morning on Sportsnet 960. Look, this is the biggest media market. There are a lot of corporate headquarters there. They don't exist in some of these smaller communities. If you're not there, these companies won't support it. But what Brunt said at the end is very true. Hey, it hasn't worked this way forever. We need to try something different. I don't know how you approach it. I don't have the sales pitch for all of it, Karen. But as Donovan said and as Stephen Brunt has said, the Argos get supported relatively well on television. They certainly don't get supported whatsoever in the stands. Is there a way to have your cake and eat it too? Can you retain the Toronto market, the greater Toronto market, as far as your television viewing numbers go, and move the team to a place where more people would come out? It's a great question. I don't have the answer, but I think there's a creative enough solution out there. I don't live in that market, so it's really difficult from the other side of the country. But there has to be something different than banging your head against the wall every single year having this conversation.
And I think of this, like, what would be the difference if they moved to the greater GTA area? Say you moved to Mississauga or you moved to some other area that's more family friendly and not Toronto and not so much. I understand the area and I understand it's pretty easy to get around, but you know the city of Toronto. You've been there. I've been to games. Like, I mean, okay, you've got Exhibition Park. People go to Exhibition Park and go on the rides and go to the fair and they love it, but for whatever reason, don't go and watch the Argos play at BMO Field. You've got Toronto in the summer. What can you do in that area? You can go to your cabin. You can go to festivals. You can go downtown. You can do a whole bunch of other things, which I think is similar to what the Vancouver problem is, too. There's just too much to do in the city that people are like, okay, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, do I want to leave the beach or the mountains today to go watch a Lions game? Or 7 o'clock at night, do I want to go leave the beach and the mountains or whatever else I'm doing and go to BC Place to watch a football game when I can catch it at home in after I'm done with the day? It strikes me as the only thing that I think that could be possible, but I don't even know if it is possible, is the idea of moving them to the suburbs. And I just don't know if that is an idea that they are willing to invest in, because I don't know what either other fields are around the greater Toronto area, Scott, that could house the Toronto Argos.
It's crazy when you think about the numbers. And I think this is the same in Vancouver, the same in Montreal. 20,000 people. It doesn't seem like a really big ask. It doesn't. Do you know what the estimated population of Greater Toronto is? Like close to 6 million people. And you're asking for about 20,000 of those people to come out. It doesn't seem like a big ask. And for whatever reason, it hasn't worked. And the population number is lower in Vancouver. The population is lower in Montreal. But there's still so many people. So what's the biggest obstacle? And the biggest obstacle remains perception. Yes, there are traffic hurdles. There are parking hurdles. There are variety of activity hurdles. But the biggest hurdle is perception. And I'm not sure exactly how you change that. And I do think there's an interesting and unique opportunity this summer. Hey, we're something to do. We're something to do. And that sounds like you're not really selling your product. But I've argued for a very long time that in these major markets, just get people out with the idea of having fun and forget about the football part of it to begin. The football part has to be secondary or tertiary in the conversation. Get them to whatever stadium you've got. Here's the fun that's going to accompany you being here. Here's why it's going to be fun. And by the way, you might actually like what happens down on that field there. Maybe you won't. I don't know. But it's going to be fun. And hopefully you start to like what happens in front of you as well as far as the entertainment goes.
And I hope that happens in Vancouver, but don't you could see a concern and with the Toronto area, Scott, with the possibility of the Blue Jays coming back this summer and what they could do at Rogers Arena? Like, could they, there's going to be dual competition, right? So are you going to choose to, can you convince the Toronto Argo people that are going to watch it on TV to go to a game when you could say maybe go to the ballpark and watch the Blue Jays, and we know how popular they are in that city? Like, it strikes me as the challenges that Toronto has is just even so much more than Vancouver, and we can get into the Lions and some of the challenges that they have, but with Toronto, the city itself is, you know, they see themselves as the center of the universe. So is the CFL, is there enough cachet to go watching a CFL game, right? Like, are you going to be, okay, well, I'm going to the CFL game, and a lot of people are like, well, oh yeah, but you're going to watch the CFL, right? Like, and I'm not putting down the CFL, but I'm talking about a bit of a snobbish attitude toward it that's in the Toronto area.
Sure, and the counter to that is MLS is nowhere near the European product, for example. It's nowhere near the caliber, and we talked about soccer snobs in this country, don't want to support MLS yet. When TFC got good, and even in years they were bad, they had pretty decent support. You're not asking for a large contingent. You're really not. Can you sell it a little different? Hamilton's an hour away. They have no problem with attendance. And I know that city has a completely different persona than downtown Toronto. Completely different persona. But there are transportation options. There are a lot of ways you could get people to the game. Maybe that's how it has to go. It's an interesting conversation. I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, but that's where we're at with this. Someone said the CFL lost us three generations ago. That's it. It's funny that that gets brought up. Karen, you know what a success it's been in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
Ottawa saw different franchises go belly up. The Rough Riders, sorry, we're folding. The Renegades, short-lived, despite the fact they got to host a Grey Cup. They were done within, what, four years, I believe, maybe five? And so there's a city that didn't support two teams, and yet it comes back and has support. And it's the perception issue I talk about. What they will tell you in Ottawa is, and Jeff Hunt was the guy behind it at the time, and he said, I was really worried. I've got two sons who are into the NFL, and they're in their early 20s. And I thought, well, how are we going to, what do they think of the CFL? And he said, what we found out is that because the CFL had been gone long enough, that the next generation didn't really have an opinion on it. It was just at ground zero. Whereas in Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, you're starting at a deficit. You've got to convince people just to get back to giving it a shot, as opposed to the ship having sailed years ago.
Well, and I think it does have to do with what the product on the field as well. The Argos were not very good the last time we saw them in 2019, and they had the Ricky Ray years, and they were good for a little bit. But again, you look at, say, Montreal, and I noticed the change in 2019 when I was there watching the game, Scott. Like, it was a fun, it was almost the full stadium at the time, and it's McGill, so they do play in a smaller stadium, but you've got Vernon Adams, you've got Kari Jones, like, you've got sellable assets on your team, and they were fun to watch play, and it seemed like the fans gravitated to them, because the one game that I got to see there, and I don't know how the entire season went, but at least they're playing the BC Lions, who had a terrible season, mind you, like, remember what happened to the BC Lions 2 years ago, and it was still a full stadium. I think it was a Friday night, and people came out to watch it. I think it has to do with the sellable assets that you have on your team.
I'm not convinced of that. I'm really not. I'm really not convinced of that. And you'd have to go to Montreal or Toronto to get a better view. But I've seen entertaining teams in the past just not get attendance. And again, that's a perception issue to me. And I don't know how you erase that. And they've tried a lot of different things. I certainly don't have all the answers. I've been a proponent in some of these cities with literally you need to bring people to the game. As crazy as that sounds. And ideas like, can you partner with craft breweries? Because you know what craft breweries are? They're cool, and they're full. And can you make those some satellite tailgate events and literally bus people to the game after they've had a couple of pops and make it an experience for them? And yes, there's an initial capital outlay there, but if those people go into work the next week or if they show up at their next barbecue and say, guys, you're never going to believe it. I didn't think I was going to go to a Lions game, or I didn't think I was going to go to an Argos game, and the next thing I knew I was on a bus having had a couple of great craft beers, got my way into the stadium. We had a pretty good time that night. We got a bus ride home, and it turned out to be a great evening. If you can get that to happen, then the initial capital outlay was worth it.
I'll point to the Winnipeg Blue Bombers and their new stadium, because I've gone in both the capacity as a reporter and I've gone in the capacity as a fan. Scott, what do? They make it a Friday night out. It's like going to the quote-unquote bar with your friends because of the way the stadium is built. It's got the open air in the concourse, right? So, you know, your friends go before the game. You can tailgate in the beer gardens, which you get in with your tickets, and you get happy hour beer prices. Guess what you can do? You can take those happy hour beers with you into the stadium because you've already used your ticket to get in. There's bouncy castles for kids. There's a whole bunch of other stuff going on. But then once you're in there, half my friends don't even sit in their seats. They stand in the concourse, congregate, can watch the game because of how the stadium's built, and talk to their friends. Like, it's built as more of a social aspect to go to the games versus just go watch a football game. Like, you want to go and have your friends, and it's a night out. It's different. It's Winnipeg. I understand that. It's a lot less things to do in Winnipeg on a Friday night than there is in Vancouver or Toronto, but they've sold it as a fun night out, and if you have 16 games in the season, you've got 8 games, 8 days out of the night where you know what you are going to do those 8 nights, right? Like, you've got 8 nights to plan for night out with your friends. They've done it right, and Saskatchewan did the same thing, but we're also talking about markets where they can do the marketing that way.
This comes in to 650, 650. You can hit us up at both inboxes, 960, 960 as well. Andy says, I don't know about Toronto, but in BC, how about the lack of media coverage? Present company excluded. Thank you, you two. You are hard-pressed to get anyone in this town to cover the Lions unless it's to blast the team and their downfalls. That might be part of it, Andy. It's always chicken and egg with that, I find. Hey, if we covered the Calgary Dinos or the UBC Thunderbirds on a semi-daily basis, would people show up at those games? Or, well, our listeners don't really want to hear about them as much, so we probably shouldn't pay attention to them or the BC Lions or whatever team you want to talk about. It's always chicken and egg. I don't disagree with the part of your point, Andy, but this is where a lot of media companies are coming from.
So this one comes in. I've always been a Lions fan, but it seems they've been gone so long. I don't really even care they're coming back. Probably doesn't help that the Lions have sucked lately. Well, 2 years ago, yes. And also the horrible rest really pissed me off. So that's another can of worms that we could go down, Scott. But let's talk about the fact that that's there's your marketing tool for the Lions. And I understand the conversation about they weren't really good 2 years ago, but we have no idea what this team even looks like right now. Yes, they have Michael Riley back. Yes, they have a bunch of good players. And Calgary has Bo Levi Mitchell back. And he is, you know, determined to get back to the level before his injuries back in 2019. But you look at these teams right now, and they're basically blank sheets in a way. And it's a blank season in a way. So in going back to your point where it is, well, just use it as something to go to right now. That's how you draw the fans back. We are the first thing to have fans back in the stadium. It's a blank slate. The past 2 years ago really doesn't matter. And we move forward from here and let's see what we can do.
Rick in Calgary says, there is no Toronto Sports Network deal. I see what you did there, Rick. For the CFL without Toronto, but that's also not the only sports network in this country. The league may need to do regional TV deals combined with a minor national deal with another network. Hard to say. More importantly, says Rick, if there's an XFL-CFL merger at some point, does the Rouge survive? Yes, that is at the top of the list, Rick. Tongue-in-cheek, of course. It's a fair point about the national media. I think most people who step back say the best thing for the league would be if you had both major players media-wise involved. If Sportsnet were forced to do more because they had the property and TSN had part of the property, we see it with the NFL, we see it with the NHL, you go multiple networks, you bring more people to the party. Some of it, I think, is out of loyalty. Maybe there's no desire on the part of Rodgers to ever really get involved, or it's not enough of an incentive financially for the league to deviate from the plan that has existed. Look, what the three-letter network did for the Canadian Football League when it was really on hard financial times, it helped. And when you talk partnership, I do believe that comes into it, but I think Rick's point is a good one. From a step-back point of view, you would force more media coverage. And would that in turn lead to butts in seats? I don't know, but it's a fair take.
Matt and Cochran, I say this as a Stampeders fan. A good stadium goes a long way for fan attendance and enjoyment, and we'll agree with that. I mean, you could even point to the experience when you go to a Calgary Stampeders game and an Edmonton Commonwealth game. I mean, the stadiums themselves are not in the greatest of conditions, but I do like the fact you can still tailgate in Calgary. You can tailgate in Edmonton. They've got the beer gardens in Edmonton. There are aspects of going to the game outside of just the stadiums themselves, but the atmosphere within them is good. And this one comes in. Tell them it's a soccer game, and then chain the doors and bring out the Argos.
That's not bad. That's not bad. Yeah, you might have to deal with a few civil liberty issues on the backside, but it's worth it to see if you can up the ante for the Toronto Argonauts. We can continue with this conversation so long as your texts keep fueling it, 960, 960, or 650, 650. We do want to get back to hockey, however, and we want to get back to moves that could happen. Caleb Jones gets traded yesterday. What does that mean for the future of Seth Jones? What other conundrums do they have to work their way out of in Columbus? We'll head there next. Aaron Portsline joins us on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Aaron Portsline is going to join us here momentarily. We were having our group discussion about what do we do for some hockey coverage today. Obviously, we didn't know the Minnesota Wild were going to do what they were going to do. And yes, we've been efforting Michael Russo or someone out of that market based on what we saw with Zach Parise and Ryan Suter in the story that Russo broke this morning, that they will both be bought out. And because we had this conversation last week, Karen, about, hey, which teams will define the offseason, like, I fired a text, you fired a text, and it's like, we can go in about 14 different directions as far as interest because there are so many compelling conversations to have right now.
Yeah, and you chose Columbus as one of yours. I didn't choose it as one of mine, but I mean, I can't argue against Columbus being one of the franchises that could define this offseason because all about what Jaro Kekäläinen is going to do with Seth Jones. Is he going to try and trade him this offseason? Does he land in Chicago now that his brother's there? But what's the asking price in return? And the big question with Seth Jones is he going to, a team that you're going to trade him to, are you going to get the go-ahead and know that he's going to sign a contract extension with you? Because I don't think you aren't going to give away the assets if it's just for a rental player. It's just not going to happen. And Elliot Friedman was talking about the fact that he believes there was a deal in place with Philly, but they weren't going to get the Seth Jones confirmation that he would sign an extension in Philly. And Philly said, well, no, we're not going to take the risk on a player and give you the assets back that a Seth Jones demands for a player that we could have as a possible rental. So I see this as it's a interesting spot for Jaromir Kekäläinen to be in because you want the assets for the player, but you also have to have the player on board with the team that you're going to saying, yes, I'm willing to sign an extension there.
Yeah, that's part of it with Seth Jones, to be sure. And that's not the only decision to be made. We were talking earlier with Mike McKenna. What do you do with your goaltending situation? You got to expose either Merzlikins or Korpisalo. Are you willing to lose one of those players? Columbus is one of those teams that always gets referenced in the Vegas expansion draft. They paid Vegas to take William Karlsson. Mm-hmm. And a part of it had to do with this goaltending issue. They didn't want to lose a goaltender at the time, and it was Korpisalo. Do they just live with it, lose a goaltender? Do they see a team like, I don't know, Toronto, and say, okay, we could flip Korpisalo to you for the right price, combined with Jack Campbell's salary. You wouldn't be paying much to your goaltenders. We know you don't have a lot of financial wiggle room. Do you pay up again to Seattle and say, look, the only way we're going to be competitive is if we're a defensive nature team again? A lot of that revolves around having a goaltending tandem, which we'd like to keep intact. We are willing to pony up an asset to Seattle. There are discussions to be had. There's Seth Jones. There's that. Max Domi. What are we doing mm-hmm. here? Patrick Laine. What is happening there? Columbus has a
about
lot
his name.
Of big. Yeah, there are a lot of big decisions to be made, and neither of those guys is up for their contract this year. But one of the things we always look ahead to in the National Hockey League is, do you have to get out in front of it a year before a guy's deal expired? Especially with a team like Columbus that has seen it happen with much more high-profile players, the likes of Artemi Panarin, Sergei Bobrovsky. Well, would you have been better off to get out ahead? At that time, it didn't make sense. They needed to take a step. I applaud Kekalainen for going in at that deadline as a franchise, just to alter the perception from even their own fan base. At some point, you got to push a few chips in. They won a playoff round. They swept the Tampa Bay Lightning, and it represented progress for the franchise. Now that they're at a different point in their cycle, do they take a different view of it moving forward?
Well, and you've got a new head coach. I mean, is this someone that can relate better or just has a different tact in relating to with a Max Domi or a Patrick Laine? Like, how much does Brad Larsson being behind the bench versus John Tortorella affect what Jarmo Kekalainen wants to do with his young players? I mean, we know Laine was disgruntled in Winnipeg, and we assume he was to a point, at least in the Blue Jackets, hasn't asked for a trade at this point. Is Max Domi a product of Scott COVID and the first season with a new team, and you can't go and meet your new teammates and socialize with your new teammates and do all the things that you would normally do? It was his down season just a product of that? Personal life, off the ice, translating to on the ice. So these are the questions that Jarmo Kekalainen is going to have to ask himself and look himself in the mirror and say, like, how much of this is real and how much of this is perceived from last season?
A lot of different ways this can go, and who better to talk to about this than Aaron Portsline of The Athletic, covers the team diligently and joins us here today on Rintoul and Sermon. Thank you very much for doing this today, Aaron. How are you?
Oh, very well, thanks. It's nice to be with you.
Absolutely, and thank you very much for making time. Caleb Jones getting traded is only going to further fuel the Seth Jones conversation. Where are we at with that right now in Columbus?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I mean, Columbus, of course, has been sidetracked here. Shouldn't say it that way. They've been devastated by the loss of Matisse Kivleniak, the goaltender, so things have sort of been put on hold a bit, but and yet the calendar won't let them entirely stop with the hockey. You know, the sense is that Jones has made it clear to them which couple of teams, a team, two teams, maybe there's three now, that he's willing to go to and sign an extension, because obviously they'll get a much sweeter return if the team acquiring him knows they can keep him long term. Less so if it's a one-off, a rental. So that's key. And I think Columbus is trying to make that work, obviously, with the teams that Jones would be willing to forego UFA with. They would be first in line from Columbus's perspective, ahead of teams that aren't certain about Jones or that he can say right now would not sign with long-term. So it's a deal, I think, that probably waits until after the expansion draft, but I think we'll have something before the end of the month, and the draft is probably when it gets done.
Your latest article at The Athletic is done in conjunction with Lisa Dillman, who covers the Kings, and it's the, hey, here would be the pros and cons of going to L.A. I'd have to assume that you believe that that's one of the teams on the short list. What does the short list look like in your mind as far as where Seth Jones might sign an extension.
Yeah, and so I think it's careful to say this has not been stamped by Seth Jones himself, or certainly not his agent, Pat Brisson. But I think the assumption with many people, the fair assumption, is that Los Angeles, Chicago, Colorado, Dallas are among the teams. Again, that I wouldn't put my hand on a Bible in a courtroom and say that. But that seems to be the feeling among teams and people around the league who tend to know these things.
Aaron, I believe it was Elliot Freeman who had made the comment that he believes that there was some sort of deal possibly in place with Philadelphia, but because of the fact that Philadelphia could not get confirmation on Seth Jones signing an extension there, they said, look, we just can't risk doing this deal. Do you have any insight on maybe something that may have been in place with Philly?
Yeah, I think Philadelphia is the team right from the start, Karen, that really, really wanted Seth Jones, that I think they may... I think you may be correct to say they're the most aggressive team out of the gate for him. One of the things that's impacting this, and this is something I just learned a few weeks ago, we've seen this before, and Columbus has taken part of these trades, where you acquire a player, and then if you re-sign that player, there's a conditional pick attached. The Blue Jackets did this with Matt Duchene from Ottawa. They gave up a first-round draft pick, among other things, to get him. And there was a conditional other first there that if Columbus had signed Duchene, the Senators would have gotten an additional first-round draft pick from Columbus. Well, those picks are no longer. It is of utmost importance that the Blue Jackets try to find those teams with which Seth Jones would extend and go from there. And Philadelphia may really, really want him, but I'm not sure they want him as much for 1 year as these other teams would. You know, be able to give up if it's a long-term contract. So these are some of the dances that are going on behind the scenes.
So we've seen it before with players that are more disgruntled and asking for trades versus the situation with Seth Jones saying, you look like I want to test free agency. We saw it with Pierre-Luc Dubois actually in Columbus, but you think of the Matt Duchene back in Colorado, and these players did start with their teams and then were traded just after the season started. Are you still leaning towards the fact that Seth Jones is likely to be gone before the season starts, or at least at the end of this month?
Yeah, so it's a very interesting question, because earlier this offseason, we think back to the time before John Davidson was here, Jarmo Kekalainen, the general manager, went on the record and said, we're not absolutely dead set on trading him this summer. We can go into next season, and maybe we'll get more from the trade deadline. And then John Davidson came back. He's now the head of hockey operations here. And without wanting to be seen as correcting Jarmo Kekalainen publicly, it's pretty clear that there's a change of direction there. John Davidson saying, this is not 2019 with Artemi Panarin, where this team, they feel, has a chance to win it all, the Stanley Cup. This is a team that, even with Seth Jones, is probably going to be struggling here. So they're not carrying Seth Jones into next season. I think they take, I mean, think of the risk that goes with that should he get injured. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to take the best deal this summer and move on. I think they're still open to Seth Jones saying, you know what, listen, the grass is not always greener. I might consider staying here. They have not burned bridges, these two parties, but unless something changes, and I don't foresee that, then I think Columbus is absolutely going to trade him here in the next few weeks.
Aaron Portsline of The Athletic in Columbus joining us here today talking Blue Jackets hockey. What's tied down? What's untouchable on the Columbus Blue Jackets roster right now?
Well, that's a good question. There's not a lot tied down. Patrick Laine, I'm led to believe if they get the right offer for Patrick Laine, that he could be on the move again. I think there are some guys you look at and say, well, yeah, Max Domi's not going to be traded right now. He just had shoulder surgery. But who are they wedded to? Who are they building around? But those are the pieces that they're going to start this summer with the three first-round draft picks. Look, Zach Werenski is going to have to make it clear to them here soon. What does he want to do? He's an RFA next summer when his deal's up. But what are his long-term plans? And then you think about some of the veteran players who may or may not have the stomach for a rebuild, because who knows how long those take. Does Cam Atkinson, a proud veteran, does he want to be here through this process? He's got several years left on his contract. I think this is a team that's going to be very aggressive and open to rebuilding the right way. And frankly, as hard as it is for some people to believe this, it's never really been done here in Columbus. They've had seasons where they've played like a rebuilding club, but they've not made the moves that match along with that. They've always tried to be as competitive as they could be, and they've always often finished in that god-awful 23 to 26 range, no man's land. I think with 5 years on John Davidson's contract and four on Jarmo Kekalainen's contract, I suggest that they're going to weaponize that term that they have and show a level of patience here that is much needed and, frankly, long overdue.
I've often made the comparison between the Buffalo Bills and the Columbus Blue Jackets, because the Bills had this reputation forever of, well, nobody wants to play there. And finally, Josh Allen's the guy who put his flag in the ground and said, I'm going to be here. I want to be here. Come ride with me.
Yep.
And we see what it's done. And a lot of other things had to happen with management and coaching and all of that. By what you're saying, it doesn't sound like Josh Allen currently exists in the organization, or if he does, it's not obvious.
And I think you're right, and I think there's something that needs to be said about that. I won't speak for Buffalo. I freaking love that town, for one. I love being in Buffalo. I don't know what that says about me. I love it, though. But I think this needs to be said about Columbus. Nobody has ever left here because of the city. I think that is way too easy. The city. And whenever people wonder why don't people want to stay with the Blue Jackets, they say, we don't know, the city's great. Well, they're not talking about the city. They're talking about the organization. What needs to be fixed is not the city. The city is fine. It may not be a draw to free agents. It doesn't have the international reputation, I'll grant you, of a Montreal, Toronto, L.A., Chicago, certainly not Miami. But I've never known a player that got here and said, I can't stand it here, I got to get out. That's never been the issue. Most guys are quite pleasantly surprised by the city. The other stuff that's got to be fixed.
Aaron, what about the expansion draft that's coming next week? There seems to be an obvious decision to be made in goal, and it can go a bunch of different ways. If there are three options, one of which is just live with it if they select one of your goaltenders, one of which is trade a goaltender this week so you get something in return, and the other being, who knows, maybe there's a more creative way to work around this and pay the way that they paid the last time to get somebody to stay away, Vegas in that case, to stay away from your goaltenders. What direction do you think management takes with the goaltending?
Well, goaltending for them, expansion-wise, is 100% fine. Korpisalo will be protected. Elvis Merzlikins is exempt. Matisse Kivlenyk's rest of soul would have been exposed to Seattle. I suspect at some point this week that Cam Johnson is a restricted free agent goaltender. He'll get a qualifying offer that will allow him to be exposed as the Blue Jackets goaltender in the expansion draft. He does qualify, so they're covered at the goaltending position. I think that the tougher read for them is at forward, where Eric Robinson for so long has been assumed to be the guy that's exposed. I think they're going to get a little creative with that. I don't think they like the idea of losing Eric Robinson. I think they protect Robinson, and I think they roll the dice by exposing either Gustav Nyquist or perhaps Max Domi, who, again, is recovering from shoulder surgery. Maybe they can get away with dangling one of those two guys out there. The assumption for most people is that they're going to lose defenseman Dean Kukan. But we'll see what transpires between now and then.
Aaron, what are you hearing with how Ron Francis is going about doing this expansion draft? We've heard he's obviously been very busy, which is, it's obviously expected, but there's also the reports out there like, look, he's not going to do any general manager's favors. So if you want him to take money off your team, like, you're going to have to do it on his terms and with some big sweeteners. What are you hearing about what Francis has been doing or likely to do?
Yeah, as it should be, right? I mean, he's not doing any favors. And frankly, I think a lot of teams, Columbus included, learned a lesson in the previous expansion draft by almost overvaluing their own players and overreacting to losing certain players. And Columbus didn't get the worst of it, but look who they let go, William Karlsson. Wow, 43 goals his first year. Nobody in Columbus saw that coming. I think teams have you know, vowed to be smarter this time around. I think you see way, way fewer no-move clauses. So teams are not handcuffed like they were last time. But if I were Seattle, I wouldn't be doing any favors either. This is the big time. People, I think his approach and the quote-unquote not doing any favors is a response to teams feeling as though they learned their lesson through George McPhee in Vegas 4 years ago. So everyone thinks they're a little bit wiser this time around. You know, Ronnie Francis is a fascinating guy. He's such a gentleman. He is such a Lady Bing candidate, but he is an incredibly competitive person. And those words resonate because I don't think he's going to let anybody get over on his franchise.
Aaron, before Pekka Rinne retired today, and then the fact that Bill Guerin bought out or will buy out both of Zach Parise and Ryan Suter, the biggest news was the fact that Duncan Keith was traded to Edmonton for obviously Caleb Jones and a third, and no salary was retained. You saw Jones play against the Columbus Blue Jackets a ton this season. Keith play against the Blue Jackets a ton this season. What did you think of the deal, and do you still have the belief that Ken Holland does that in the right situation, Keith can get back to being a higher defenseman in the league?
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, far be it for me to question Ken Holland. He is obviously, that's an exceptional general manager with the reputation that backs that up. To me, it's a great trade for Chicago. I mean, this is one of those, if you're the Blackhawks, the idea of being able to unload, just flat trade Duncan Keith and not retain any salary, that's a really good day to get a promising young player, Caleb Jones, back. That floored me. And then in addition, at least a third-round pick. I think the Blackhawks got the kind of gift that the great teams seem to continually get. They always get off the hook one way or the other, and I think Edmonton let him off the hook with that situation big time. Duncan Keith has had an incredible career, but do I see him getting back to Duncan Keith again at the age of 38, which I think he'll be next season? That's hard for me. That is hard for me to envision. I think that's a player, again, an incredibly accomplished player, but there's so much tread off those tires. I suspect early, or not too deep into the season, he'll start to look much like he did this year again.
And then the Oilers fans get even louder. Hey, Aaron, this is great stuff, man. I really appreciate you taking the time. It's a fascinating week in hockey, and that's going to continue into the draft next week as well. Thank you very much for doing this, and who knows, the way things are getting shaken up right now, we might be calling you tomorrow.
Excellent. Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Aaron.
That is Aaron Portsline with the Athletic in Columbus. I'll take the L on that. For whatever reason, I hadn't committed that Elvis Merzlikins was draft exempt as far as expansion draft goes. You know, sometimes you get confused between teams. I had it in my head that they had a protection issue with their goaltenders. They did not. I'm glad that Aaron Portsline corrected me on that. They'll just have to find a way to sign Cam Johnson so they can expose him in the expansion draft. And maybe if he gets taken, he probably doesn't, as Aaron outlined there. Maybe it's a new opportunity for him. They've got so many other questions, though, and I think the point he made is a good one. Nobody in his mind has ever said, I don't want to be in Columbus, the city, but it's the organization and it's the lack of stability or the lack of forward progress that has driven some players away.
But don't you think that's why they brought back the likes of, well, not brought back, but are promoting to different roles within the organization, like a Rick Nash and a Derek Dorsett and the other name, the other name escapes me right now. He played in Edmonton as well. But still, they're bringing back guys that are coming back to not just the city of Columbus, but back to work for the organization, right? So these guys can sell them on the organization themselves and the city themselves, right? So it's, I think that speaks to maybe Jarmo Kekalainen understands that they're going in a younger direction right now. They're going to have a lot of draft picks, and you're going to have guys in player development roles that went through some of the development with this organization at different times. So I do think that that was a key for them in just understanding, like, look, we have to build from our prospects up at this point, and we need to figure out a way to keep prospects here, want them to sign with us, want them to stay here long-term. So I do think that's a savvy move by Kekalainen.
It is, as long as you find the right guys and as long as you find the core. And that is one of the other things that Aaron was speaking to. Hey, this does need to be looked at. Is there enough of a pipeline? Do they have enough high end? That's been part of the problem for quite some time. Not when they had Panarin and some of the other big names out there, but do you have enough coming in the pipeline where you go, well, here's what we're building around? Maybe we haven't been great at putting the other deck chairs around those players, but do we have somebody that we are committed to moving forward? And as he said in that interview, I can't tell you what's tied down. You'd think that Patrick Laine might be, but I think if the right trade came along, they might move on that. They're supposed to be tied down with Seth Jones. He's kind of told them that's not going to happen. Where do they go with Zach Werenski? Based on that, they've got a little more time in that situation. Just part of the fascinating conversation of the National Hockey League right now, one that continues this week. The clock is ticking. What's going to happen by Saturday? We've seen some big moves in the last couple of days. Did we just get another one? I saw you point there at your screen. Did something happen?
No, the name Mark Legestu came to my mind. That was the player that I couldn't figure out from the Columbus Blue Jackets. No, Scott, I'm sorry. I'm not saying there's more breaking news. There may be when we come back on the other side. Maybe if we throw that out into the universe, we'll get another breaking news of sorts. But no, it was just Mark Letestu's name.
I'm not sure how many people would have thrown out the hypothetical of Parise and Suter being bought out in Minnesota today. It seemed like a pipe dream. It is happening. We've got hypotheticals, and this may be a little more difficult to recreate because we're going to need a hot tub time machine, but it's fun, and we'll do it next on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
He put on a show again last night. He really did. Finishes it in walk-off fashion. Second home run title, which means you know he's coming back. You know he's coming back. Like, quite often, the home run contest had, in previous years, Karen, it had kind of fallen into the dunk contest category of, mm-hmm. Okay, I won it once, but I'm not going to do that again. You do need to have those people who come back, the standard bearers, and say, you're going to have to beat me. You're going to have to take this belt. Pete Alonso showing us the belt after he hit that one.
And isn't he a great personality to have be that guy that's the two-time defending champion coming out? Like, he doesn't lack confidence. After when his interview after he won, he says, I feel I'm the best power hitter in the game, and I showed it tonight. His brashness, his boldness, his cockiness, whatever you want to call it, the amount of fun he was having up there, it doesn't help that he was hitting bombs left, right, and center. Like, it was just fun to watch him do it and fun to watch the fact that he was having fun, bopping to the music, just living life out there. He's like, yeah, I know Shohei Ohtani, you all came to see him, but hey, look at me. I'm still pretty good.
Major League Baseball did well last night. Shohei Ohtani was the story for many people because of the length of home runs he was hitting despite falling in the first round in a swing off. Good night for Juan Soto in that regard. So they get the swing off, and Ohtani's a part of it despite the fact he doesn't win it. It's a good night for Soto, who's had his ups and downs over the course of this year. Trey Mancini and everything he's battled health-wise, yeah, Making it to the final was a good story. And then you got Pete Alonso repeating as the champ. Is the home run derby at the top of your list when it comes to must-see skills competitions? Is it bigger to you than the dunk contest or the three-point contest or hardest shot, fastest skater? What's your top-of-the-list must-see skills contest?
I think it has to be the home run derby. Like, you go into it thinking, okay, like, these guys are going to just get to hit home runs, you know, let's see how far they can hit it. But it does end up becoming an event almost every time. Like, there's always some sort of dramatics towards a guy's hit. He needs 6 home runs in the final 45 seconds. Can he get that? Or a guy's 2 back with 10 seconds. Is he going to get enough hits to try and hit the home run? Like, there's always some sort of dramatic aspect to the home run contest. And I point to the dunk contest not anymore just because of what you just pointed out. Like, it just tends to be been there, done that. You don't get the best players in the NBA, the best dunkers in the NBA. It generally tends to be a young kid's competition. Three-point competition, I could maybe argue, because you do get this, you know, the Steph Currys of the world that do compete in this. You see some of the best shooters. But again, it's just, it's not the theatrics of the home run derby. And I have no idea what they do in the Pro Bowl. I don't even care. Like, that's one of the ones that's way off my list. Don't they do some sort of dodgeball competition on the Saturday, Scott, or something? Like, I have no idea. But yeah, I think I'm going
to
play home run, 3-point, and then dunk competition. And maybe I'll add in, it's pretty fun to see the fastest skater competition in the NHL. But that's like a distant fourth.
They used to do something around the Pro Bowl. They used to have that quarterback competition. It wasn't always around the Pro Bowl. A lot of times they do it in the offseason. It was kind of fun. Kind of fun to watch those star quarterbacks go head-to-head. But football doesn't have anything that's close. Home run derby, the other benefit it gets is there's nothing else going on. Nothing else going on to consume you on a weekend. And maybe you're not into all-star festivities in the other sports. Or maybe because you've been watching hockey or basketball every single weekend leading up, that you're fine just taking a weekend off when the competition isn't for real, if you will. Home run derby just falls at a time where that's what's on, and there's nothing else competing with it. It's the benefit of the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, which is also, in my opinion, the best All-Star Game of all of sports, and I don't think it's even close.
Yeah, I mean, Dan Shulman talked about this yesterday with Jamie and myself, Scott. He said it's the one that is most like the actual game. The NBA one becomes a little competitive towards the end if it's close because players want to win. But now they've changed it to individual quarters, then the addition of those quarters, and there's a whole bunch of different stipulations. The NHL All-Star Game, like 3-on-3, it's fine, it's fun, but it's just kind of blah sometimes when you go out there. And again, the Pro Bowl is the Pro Bowl. None of the good players really ever show up. So I do think that there's something to be said about the MLB All-Star Game. I like the fact that they just don't make it the outcome now, the winner, the outcome of who gets home field advantage in the World Series, because I thought that was so stupid. And if you look at this year, like, I think the AL is going, they've won 3 in a row, but if you look at the competitors on the AL team versus the competitors on the National League team and the quality of teams in both different leagues, like, the AL is far better this season. And if you're going to have, by chance, the NL wins it just by chance, and then they get home field advantage, even though that team is just really diminished compared to the American League team they're going to in the World Series, I just think that's unfair. So I'm happy they changed that rule.
Sounds like they're going to change a couple other rules that we're currently living with. Just before we get to the hypotheticals and the hot tub time machine, sounds like runner on second base in extra innings might go the way of the dodo bird. I'm a little disappointed by that. I think it brings excitement to the game. I don't mind extra innings, but I like that twist. I've enjoyed it. The other thing that looks like it's going by the wayside is the seventh inning doubleheader, which a lot of people liked simply because it sped things up, but others didn't like because you could have something like, oh, I don't know, a 7-inning no-hitter that doesn't actually count as a no-hitter.
Exactly, right? Then we don't have to have that as an asterisk in the column and just call it a 7-inning no-hitter. I like them going back to the more traditional. Baseball likes to be the traditional sport, and I like them going back to the 9-inning games. I understand wanting to speed them up. I'm kind of indifferent when it comes to a runner on second base. Yes, it adds excitement at times, but then I've heard the argument like, well, why don't you put it one out as well because you've got a runner at second base just to change the game up. So I'm happy they're going back to the more traditional baseball rules.
So you're against fun.
I'm running a beer mile, Scott, so I don't know if I'm against fun or not.
It's a good point. Great point by you. That was a good counter to my jab there. All right, the hypothetical hot tub time machine, which we will ask you to get into as a baseball fan, or at least a fan of the home run derby. We're going to bring Jamie and Greg into this conversation as well. And just as a quick aside, if I could get in my own personal hot tub time machine and go back to when I was a kid, how fun would it be to be one of those kids in the outfield at an all-star game home run derby shagging fly balls out there? That would be awesome. Like, the coolest game of 500 up ever.
It'd be cool until you're that kid last night that hurt himself. Did you see that? The guy got carted off. See, no fun league over here. I'm going to tell you about why it's not going to be fun with the potential of getting hurt, Scott. Debbie Downer, I like to wear that hat a lot of the time. It would be pretty cool just thinking, like, I caught one of Shohei Ohtani's foul balls or ground outs, whatever it is. I think it's a pretty cool story when you get to go to show and tell and say, here's what I got today.
Just stay away from the wall, kids. I don't want you bringing back a potential home run. Can you imagine if that ever happened? Like, they're doing the home run derby, and some kid's like, this is my chance. Climbs the wall, pulls one back. How about that catch? You just screwed a guy who was in the home run competition. I know that never happens, but let's get back to the hypothetical. I promise we're going to bring Jamie and Greg into this. You guys were going to do this yesterday, but it got usurped because of Duncan Keith getting moved to the Edmonton Oilers and all of the fallout and reaction that came along with that. You guys started looking at the home run derby. And I will not take any credit for this, so I will allow you to lay out the idea, and then we'll engage it.
Basically, we said eight batters like it is right now. What's the all-time home run derby that you want to see? And we kind of had to put some parameters on it because we didn't want to go back to, like, the Babe Ruth or, you know, the Murderer's Row that the Yankees had back in the day, just because we never saw these people actually play live. So it's people basically in your lifetime, kind of mid-80s to now. That was basically the parameters. There's also this one. There's no asterisks. There's no, you can't be in the Hall of Fame and you can't be in the Home Run Hall of Fame because of the fact you may or may not have taken a certain enhanced substance at a certain time. So we're doing, so I'll use the word, you can use juiced or non-juiced, Scott. Go with it.
So Barry Bonds, for example, you get him at his peak powers, whether
yes.
those powers were enhanced or not, and we all know that they were, but that's the Bonds you get. You get the guy who's hitting 73
yes.
home runs. He is in your home run derby. If you want to put him there, this isn't my idea. I will let you lay the groundwork first. I think we're going to have a lot of similarities here. I think there are a lot of obvious choices in the last 30 to 35 years, which is what spans, you know, your viewing, mm-hmm. Jamie's viewing. Greg's a little younger, so I will work within that parameter as well. Who's on your list?
Okay, so my first list is Ken Griffey Jr., best pure hitter that I've ever seen hit the ball. You've got the kid with the backwards hat at the dish. He's won it three times. You have to put Ken Griffey Jr. Mark McGwire, won it in 92, the raw power in his prime. I want him and Sammy Sosa from that year of 1998 when they went toe-to-toe in that long-lost summer, Scott. That back and forth, I want them squaring off in the first round. Barry Bonds, he won it in 96. It's obvious, the home run hitter, but yes, I do want Juice Barry Bonds from San Francisco. Jose Canseco, you saw Pete Alonso last night. The personality. Can you imagine Jose Canseco times 100 in an event like this? Vladdy Sr. versus Vladdy Jr. I want to see that showdown as well. Vladdy had one of the more historic... Junior, I should say, had won more of the historic rounds, that 41 home runs. Vlad Sr. won it. We know he can hit the ball out of the park. And I'm going with Shohei Ohtani just because of the raw power that he has. And I do think he needs to be in there. He is a generational player. I want to see him in a competition against the best of the best. That is my eight players.
All right, we've got some disagreement on our lists. And there's a lot of agreement here. And Jamie, I'll let you jump in because you put your list together before I put mine together. I have five, maybe six players as I work through Karen's list that were on hers that are on mine. How much of your list differs from Karen's?
Yeah, so there's a lot of overlap, which I don't think is any surprise because I had Griffey, Bonds, McGwire, Sosa, and I had Canseco purely for the comic relief aspect, mm-hmm. right? Like if anyone is just going to completely screw up and not understand the rules or do something just outrageous and ridiculous, it would be Jose Canseco. So I think you have to have him in there. You know, if we had done this yesterday, I would have said Shohei Ohtani as well. He's still a really good choice, but I think after the repeat performance from Pete Alonso, you got to include him. Like, he clearly loves the event. He takes it really seriously. He's incredibly good at it. So I think if you're just looking for someone who's invested and you know can put on a show in this event, I think you got to go for Pete Alonso. And then with my last two selections, I went for some kind of sentimental favorites. So number one, I'll have Larry Walker, just to give myself a Canadian rooting interest. And he had plenty of power in his bat as well. And then my final participant, a little bit off the board, but again, close to my heart, I'm going to go with Carlos Delgado. Obviously, I'm a big Blue Jays fan. I was a huge Delgado fan growing up. I just think he's become a really, really underrated player. And maybe because he was playing in an era where so many guys were using something a little extra to boost their home run numbers, he wasn't appreciated at the time. But he was a monster hitter for the Jays. So I'll throw Delgado in there as a sentimental favorite for myself as well.
Okay, so you wanted a Canadian there. You chose Larry Walker. Oh, the guy. I guess is my mic back? Oh, Karen has lost her mic, I believe. Or maybe I've lost mine. I'm good? All right, I've cut out. We've had a little technical difficulty. You wanted a Canadian in there, Jamie? Why didn't you go with Justin Morneau, who actually won this competition?
I never found Morneau to be that exciting as a player. And look, he had a very great career. He's Canadian. I understand he won the competition. I would rather see Larry Walker. That's all it comes down to.
Okay, fair enough. I just thought I'd ask the question. Just want it noted in there that Justin Morneau won this competition. I don't have a problem with you choosing Larry Walker. I don't have him on my list. I don't have Justin Morneau on my list. I just thought it should be pointed out that a Canadian actually got the job done in this competition at some point in time. I'm with Jamie on Pete Alonso. Shohei Ohtani is a spectacle. He's a unicorn. He's all of those things. I don't know how you argue with him winning two in a row and having a chance to come back and multiple chances to come back and tie Ken Griffey Jr. for the most home run derby crowns all time. I'm with you guys on Bonds, McGuire, Sosa, Griffey Jr., Canseco. I'm with Jamie on Alonso as well. And I do feel like we come down to brass tacks here on the last couple of spots. I know you probably don't like him, and this is probably why you don't have him in there. Alex Rodriguez needs to be in this competition, and he was never my favorite player, and even though I wasn't a Mariners fan, I despise the way he left that organization and showed up in Texas, and I don't like the Yankees and all of that. Alex Rodriguez is one of the great home run hitters of the last 30 years. A-Rod has to be in this. Karen, Jamie, you need to answer for leaving him off your list. Why is Alex Rodriguez not in your list?
I kind of forget about him, not to just simplify it, but I kind of like, oh yeah, there was A-Rod and I could have put him on and he's a home run hitter and that's what he did in his career. But it's like, he's just kind of moved to the booth and he's become a announcer for me now. You know, like it's like his career is kind of just behind him. So, hey, Scott, I give you props for putting him on there. He was not somebody that I actually even considered to put on my list.
Jamie, you
need to answer as well. Yeah, I think the thing with A-Rod, Scotty, is that he was such a complete player that you almost tend to overlook the home run power that he had. I mean, he hit 57 home runs one year, right? Like, he could hit the ball out of the ballpark, but because he was good at pretty much every aspect of baseball for so long, you don't think of him as a pure home run hitter. And just his personality, I don't know if he would be that exciting. We've already got heels in this. We've got villains in this contest, right? We've got Barry Bonds and Sammy Sosa, and Jose Canseco can certainly play that role. So I get it. He has the power to justify being in there, but it just doesn't quite sneak in my field.
Well, that, because of the wrestling aspect, is why I want him in there. Yeah, we've got heels. We want about 50% heels in this contest. We want polarization. We want heroes. We want villains. I'm adding, certainly when he was a player, another villain to this list. So A-Rod is on my list as well. We're going to get to Greg's in a second because I have a sense. He hasn't told me what all of his are, but he kind of gave me a sense that he's going off the beaten path. So I want to hear it because it differs a lot from what the three of us have come out with. So this leaves me with one spot. And you guys have made very good cases for the likes of Vladdy Jr., Vladdy Sr., Larry Walker, Carlos Delgado. Prince Fielder is a guy who has to get some consideration here. Mm-hmm. It's easy to forget about him. He doesn't have some of the lofty career totals, but he won this competition twice. And when you're deciding on one of these last spots, it's, okay, do you put an all-time great home run hitter, or do you put somebody who's fared well in this particular competition? I consider Prince Fielder. I consider Josh Hamilton, who had mm-hmm. one of the great all-time rounds, hitting 28 in the first round back in the day, and it was just such a spectacle of power. Bobby Abreu had that incredible home run derby, and everybody thought it was going to vault him into superstardom. Didn't quite happen, but there's another name I considered. Karen, I agreed with you on Vladdy Sr., and it was the entertainment factor as much as anything else. I think Vladdy Jr. might end up being a better hitter long term, and some of it has to do with plate discipline, but it's the lack of plate discipline I want. I want Vladdy Sr. hitting balls that bounce in the dirt out of the yard. It's crazy the stuff he would have. Like Juan Soto last night, Juan Soto took a couple of pitches when it came down to the get three swings, and he went, well, that's not my pitch. Vladdy Sr.'s not taking any pitches. Vladdy Sr.'s swinging at everything, which would have been incredible to watch in conjunction with all the rest of the people on the list.
Yeah, you have no idea if it's going to be far outside, if he's going to reach for that, or if it's going to be a golf ball. It would be an entertainment factor. I only put him in for the fact that I did want to see him play against his son. I thought that would be very entertaining to see father and son. We've got a bunch coming into the inbox, but before we get to those, should we get to Greg's off the beaten path list that we expect to have?
Yeah, I want to hear this, Greg, because I am curious based on what you told me during the break. You didn't say a single name, but you kind of said, well, I went with my own personal selection, so let me hear it.
Well, now I feel like I'm going to be underwhelming because I didn't go that far off the beaten path. But yeah, I went with Karen's instruction, which was, you know, players that you want to see in the home run derby. So I went with a lot of the similar guys, but a lot of guys that are different too. And A-Rod, I'll tell you right off the bat right now, is not on my list, Scott. I already have two Yankees on this list. That's too much Yankees already, so I can't have another one
okay.
on there.
All right.
And I tried to keep my bias a little bit out of it, so I didn't go with the Canadian picks like Jamie did. I tried to stay away from the Jays as much as I could, but one bias did shine through, and that there's a lot of sweet swinging lefties on this list, and starts with Ken Griffey Jr. I think that's everyone wants to see him at the Home Run Derby. He's kind of the player that was built for the Home Run Derby with a swing like that, so you can't keep him off the list. Number two for me was Barry Bonds. He's the home run all-time leader. I don't know how you can keep a guy like that off. Then I went with Albert Pujols as my next pick. I don't think anyone else had that.
Nope.
But he's up there. He's at 675 home runs right now. He's closing in on 700. And he still has one of the biggest home runs I ever recall seeing at the NLCS in 2005 off the train tracks in Houston. So I got him on the list. Then I got Reggie Jackson on there. He played into the 80s, and I heard the 80s were open for picking, so I went with Reggie Jackson. He has a home run, the legendary All-Star home run, hitting it over the roof of the old Tiger Stadium. So I don't know how you can not include a guy like that on your list. I also went with Giancarlo Stanton. I just think the ball comes off his bat differently. He doesn't hit the huge, high, lofting home runs. He hits line drives that are still rising out of the park by the time they get over the fence. So I want him in my home run derby. I have him up against Frank Thomas, the Big Hurt. I haven't heard that name yet either. And he was a guy, he was a former Jay. I got to see him live in Toronto. Wasn't in his prime when he was in Toronto, but he was chasing down the record. And, you know, he's the guy that comes up to the plate and you sit up in your chair because you just want to see what he does. And Frank Thomas, I'd want him in his prime in any home run derby that I'm watching. And then my fourth matchup that I have is where I went off the board a little bit, Scott. I went with Who Let the Dogs Out. So I have Mo Vaughn, the hit dog. And if you guys don't know who Mo Vaughn is, former Red Sox in the 90s, he was a masher, man. He was a linebacker turned first baseman who could mash. He was the hit dog. I have him up against the crime dog, Fred McGriff, as my final matchup.
I like Fred McGriff. I like the Hall of Fame argument with Fred McGriff. I can't put him in my all-time home run derby. I can't put Mo Vaughn there. It was a very short-lived, like, he was that meteoric rise and then fall off because of injury, went down to the Angels and played down in California as well. Frank Thomas just doesn't do it for me. Like, a really good player, but not an exciting player. And the home run derby is built on excitement.
And that's why this one, I should have thought of this, and he won it back in 2010. That's Big Poppy. Like, you want some personalities? You think Big Poppy at the dish, would that be a fun one to have? I mean, maybe not would come out as the victor, but you never know how he has won it in the past. So you think of, I was thinking of personalities combined with beautiful swings, and that's the Ken Griffey Jr. and guys that would succeed in an event like this. Remember, you have to think of it now, and if it is an event now, I mean, it's about it's about cardiovascular as well. Well, and how long you can sit up there. Like, these guys have to take a ton of swings, and they talked about how Pete Alonso, you know, how his legs might have been gone by the time he was done, but it didn't show because he obviously just has that much of a powerful swing. So I do think, like, David Ortiz would be fun to have in a competition like this.
Like McGriff, Thomas, and Albert Pujols, who are all on Greg's list, they all fall under the umbrella, to me, of better player than just home run hitter. And I'm looking just at home runners. It's not that those guys can't hit home runs. I think that they had more to their games than that. If I were going to put on a modern-day Yankee, I would put on Aaron Judge before Stanton just because of how big he is, and it's a larger-than-life conversation. And I know what Stanton used to be able to do, and I know he does it with less consistency now. He's still able to get the job done. I don't think it's a bad choice, Greg. I personally would elect to go Judge. I didn't go as far back as Reggie Jackson. You said, how can you not have him on your list? Probably because it's not in October. It's in midsummer. He's Mr. October. That's why I wouldn't have him on my list. But I don't think that's a bad call from the hot tub time machine. All right, you didn't go as far off the board as I thought. While I disagree with your choices, I feel they are validating. Nice job, Greg. Nice job of validating.
Thank you. That's all I needed to hear, Scotty.
A lot of people, well, not a lot of people. Frank Thomas came in. Marcus and Gibson says Bo Jackson. Bo knows home run derbies. That's a really good one. Again, not a long-lived major league career, but he won himself a home run derby. Oh, did he? Yeah, did he win it? No, he hit that crazy shot at the All-Star game. That's what he did. Bo Jackson back. I mean, I love Bo Jackson. You're tugging. I didn't like the Royals, but I love Bo Jackson. So, Marcus, you don't even have to justify that one to me.
I'm going to give you this one, Scott, because this is more in your wheelhouse, because these are two guys that have won it, but I was, I mean, you were younger back then, don't worry, but I was also of the age of just 8 years old. So I'm going to give you Ryan Sandberg. These are called some middleweights. How about Ryan Sandberg, who won it back in 1990? You will remember him playing for the Cubs. And Eric Davis, who won it back in 1989. It's an asterisk because it is actually a tied home run derby that he won in 1989 with Ruben Sierra. That was the Reds versus the Rangers, Anaheim Stadium. What do you think about those two?
I really liked Eric Davis as a player. I was a fan. I wasn't a fan of the Reds, but I did like Eric Davis as a player back in the day. I think he's criminally underrated from that era. I think that's a really good selection. Again, I wouldn't put him on my all-time list, but I like him. Ryan Sandberg, really good player. He's a Hall of Fame second baseman. He's an incredible player. I don't think of him in terms of home runs, despite the fact that he did win this competition.
And he did win.
Like, there's another one. Sorry, Karen, there's another offshoot to this. Like, you could have taken this a completely different direction, those, like, underrated power guys who you don't think of being in the home run competition, and you could just put them up against some of their peers and go down that road. But I think most of us just went big boppers from yesteryear.
Yeah, I just wanted to see the guys that, in their prime, put on a show, and if you want to give me Coors Field with the high altitude and what can happen and how far those balls can go, I just think it'd be an incredible event. That's why I put it out there for the boys yesterday. I know you guys are all big baseball fans, so thank you for indulging me in doing the greatest home run derby that you think you could put together.
I like Keith and Kit's list very quickly here. He said, and here's why I put my list down. I don't care about the most home runs. I want to see the longest home runs, says Keith. That's a different way to do it. And maybe Aaron Judge would be on that list if you were going that way. Mark McGwire, Andres Galarraga, the big cat, could hit some moonshots. Jose Canseco, Mike Piazza, Glenn Allen Hill. There is a pull from way back. And you want to talk out of left field. That one's in the left field bleachers. That's a pull. Cecil Fielder. Yep. Big Daddy, he could go long. Adam Dunn with the Reds, also a guy, White Sox as well. And then Giancarlo Stanton, injury replacements being Mo Vaughn and Jim Thome. Fun conversation, lots of feedback coming in. We got a lot of feedback on another topic. It kept pouring in even after we were discussing it, so perhaps we'll dive back into that conversation, get you a couple notes and quotes next, wrap things up on Rintoul and Sermon.
You're listening to Rintoul and Sermon.
Nobody mentioned that name. It's a good one, though. I see coming into one of our text message inboxes. You're welcome and encouraged to interact with the show throughout the duration of this program. 960, 960, 650, 650. Manram, as in Manny Ramirez. Karen, you talked about getting somebody who could flat out hit, but also somebody who had some personality. Different dude. Manny being Manny, but Manny Ramirez qualifies.
David versus Goliath. I want to see Aaron Judge versus Jose Altuve, especially after what happened over the weekend, Scott. Maybe it'll be in Houston and Jose Altuve will be tarps off and Aaron Judge will have a batting jacket on or a jacket on because it's too cold in there. That'd be one I could see, plus the height difference and all that kind of fun that goes with it. I like that one. That's unsigned texture, but yes, that's a pretty good one.
Do you need to have garbage can banging in a home run comp? Like, does that help you at all? Do you need to know what pitch is coming? No?
Maybe Altuve does. Maybe that's why he decided not to go in this year. He needed a little help at the dish from the batting practice.
I'm disappointed I didn't think of it earlier, but that was my way I could get a couple other of those names into the competition without actually having them in the competition. Like, I went with Vladdy Sr. over Jr. You had them both batting, but what if I had Vladdy Jr. throwing to Vladdy Sr. because I put him on my list? And what if I had Ken Griffey Sr. throwing to Ken Griffey Jr. because I had Jr. on my list.
See, the thrower is key on this. Like, did you see how P. Alonso yesterday, whoever was throwing to him, dialed it up for him every time. The pitch was perfect, belt high, down the middle. He could just hit it right out of the park. He never had to worry about where that pitch was coming. It's very key to a competition like this. How about Jeff Bagwell? This comes in from Kellen and Medicine Hat. Jeff Bagwell, he loved the batting stance, and he could mash it with Rafael Palmeiro.
I'm not a Palmeiro guy. Good player back in the day. Bagwell, yeah, because he had so much power, and it was, I mean, he was just jacked, and we can talk about why and what you believe he was on or wasn't on back in the day. Palmeiro, not as much. Palmeiro, not as much. Great player. Great player. Lied when he was on the stand. It was proven to be lying, and that was pretty easy, and obviously his reputation suffered because of that. Yeah, I would put Bagwell there before Palmeiro myself. I'm trying to remember who it was, and the name escapes me right now, and I'm really disappointed. But there was somebody from Greater Vancouver who was the thrower of record for one of the big home run hitters in the home run competition in recent years. Well, actually, you know what? John Schneider threw to Vladdy, didn't he? So it was John Schneider who managed the Vancouver Canadiens. It was John Schneider who is now on the bench of the Toronto Blue Jays and managed Vladdy at AA in New Hampshire, who threw to Vladdy Jr. I can remember having him on, and he talked about the fact that when a guy's having a round like that and he's doing something you haven't seen before, you do start to feel a little pressure as the guy who's delivering the ball to the plate. Like, you better get it in there, especially on the timed part of the competition. Like, don't be wasting too many. Like, that one that slipped out, whose hand did it slip out of last night? It was whoever was throwing to Juan Soto.
Yeah.
And they joked about it, and that one went behind Soto and ran its way to the backstop, and everybody's having a good laugh about that.
Yeah, I saw those ones. And you do think about the fact that there is pressure to keep consistently throwing the ball where it was. That's why Pete Alonso's was so much more impressive, because the guy who was dealing to him was just lobbing it to the perfect spot where he could get to the sweet spot of his swing. This one comes in from Dave Cespedes. He won it twice. Yes, he did, back in 2013. He's just not a player that's memorable to me, Scott, in when I talk about competitions like that. Jim Tomei, Farm Boy Strong. Be interesting to have into this one. And this one came in because it's father versus son. You'd have Vlad Sr. versus Dante Bichette and Vladdy Jr. versus Bo Bichette. Most combined homers win. I think you might be, well, I don't know. I'll leave that to you. Would you lean towards the younger or the, I guess we're having these guys in the best version of themselves, so I can't really say the young guys versus the old guys, but it is, you know, father, son in their prime versus sons in their prime. I'm not sure who'd win that.
I could be wrong, but I think the texter is suggesting right now. Like Vladdy Sr.
Right now. Oh, geez.
And Vladdy Jr. against Dante Bichette and Bo Bichette, like who wins with combined homers right now? I'm still going with the Guerreros. I'm still going with the Guerreros on this one, but it's a good question. Dante Bichette could get it done, and Bo Bichette obviously going to be participating in the All-Star game tonight. We know when he gets himself in a groove, he can get it out of the park.
I like how Greg is sending us the best Mo Vaughn moments to our Twitter account, Scott. It's not home run competition. It's Mo Vaughn charging, coming in after someone charges the dish. Very good, Greg. Thank you very much for keeping me distracted during the show.
A lot of people weighing in on that. A lot of people weighing in on something we discussed earlier in the show as well. It's Rintoul and Sermon, and thanks for texting in. I want to get to a few of these right now. We had this conversation about the Canadian Football League, and it often takes this direction. You start talking about one market, what needs to be done, and the question of the day, Stephen Brunt, Ryan Pinder brought it up, and we transported it onto this show because I do believe it's a good conversation. Do you need the Toronto Argonauts for the Canadian Football League to work? And many people close to that market say yes, and it has everything to do with national headquarters and sponsorship, and what does it do as far as a loss for revenue if you take the Argonauts out of that market? And the people on the other side say, well, look, if you're going to get people in the GTA watching on television but not going to the games, can you put them in, for lack of a better city, Kingston? Mm-hmm. Like, Kingston has good support, not to the Laval level, but it has good support for Queens. They have a good college football program there, and they've had good support there. Can you put them in Guelph? Can you put them in Kingston? Can you put them somewhere outside of Toronto where it is seen as cool in that market? It is seen as something to do in that market. It's been asked about the BC Lions in the past, number of years. Well, could you move the BC Lions to the Okanagan and draw, if you put them, let's say you put them in Kelowna, could you draw from Kelowna, Penticton, Kamloops, Vernon, and with people only having to come in once every couple of weeks on average, and it being anywhere from a two-hour drive to less, could you make that work? And could you have a centralized team? Could you get enough people there if you could have the facility? I think it's a good question to ask. I mean, that's what they're trying to do with a team in Atlantic Canada, Karen. They're trying to say, all right, we'll put a team in Moncton eventually, and that's kind of been pushed to the wayside, or wherever you go. It's not just because we think that city can support it. We think the surrounding area can support it.
Yeah, and the Atlantic Canada area supports their college football as well. Canadian CIS, or U Sports College Football. We saw the dominance of St. Mary's for a long time out east with Blake Neal at the helm. Actually went to a Vanier Cup where Manitoba lost to St. Mary's in Toronto. Not a very happy day for my alma mater, but I digress. That's the thing that's tough about these big cities. You've got transportation issues. You've got where your demographics are issues. Like, think about it. Like, if you're where are you trying to draw from? If you're in Toronto, you've got, you know, a lot of singles. You've got a lot of young couples that maybe don't have families. More in the suburbs, you've got more of the families if you want to draw this to make it a family event. The same thing that happens here in Vancouver. You look at the demographics that are living downtown versus the demographics that are now living in the Langley, the Surrey, Abbotsford, Chilliwack area. That's where more of the families are if that's where you want to try and draw that family experience and the young fans. And someone sent us a really good text in from Calgary. Said, hey, late to the conversation, but as a 50-year-old, I started taking my 14-year-old daughter to Stamps games 2 seasons before COVID. She was learning the game and having fun with the atmosphere, the food, and of course she ran into her girlfriend by accident in the concourse. The CFL has to target teens. It's an affordable night out, cheaper than the movies. So I think that's what you and I always target about. It's how do we target the teens? How do we target young kids? But also, too, we have to target that 20-year-old group that's going to say, I want to make this cool to go out for a night on a Friday, Saturday afternoon, whatever the case is.
This always comes back to who do you target? And it's a really tough question. There will be some that say, you can't exclude your fan base, which, yes, is an older demographic. You can't completely exclude those who are 45, 50, 55 plus, because those are people who supported your product and they're going to pass it down to their grandkids all the way down the line. And at the same time, they're not going to be those with the most disposable income in years to come. So do you go after the 20 somethings or do you say, we lost those people already, let's go younger than that, and we want to get, let's just say, hey, I know families are all over the place in terms of the parents, but let's just say, younger parents with kids that are 6 to 16, can you get them out? Like, who exactly do you go after? And it's a different question depending on which market you talk about. The bottom line is this. In the bigger cities, you have to get over this hurdle of perception, and it's tough to do. I don't think enough inventiveness has been used, and I understand there are handcuffs in certain situations. Someone said CFL needs to reduce beer, concession costs in struggling markets, captive audience pricing stops working when the audience has walked away. That's fair, but in many of these larger venues, you've got unions involved and the teams don't actually control the concessions, and thus they don't control the concession prices. They're kind of at the mercy of the venue that they're in, depending on which market you're talking about.
That is very true. And like you think about, but the NHL, what's the cost of a beer at an NHL game? It's like $15, $20 if you want to go right now. So you kind of, but you want, it's a different perception of going to an NHL versus going to a CFL game. This one came in to 960, 960. It says, if product on the field is even good, then the fans would have a reason to go. Speaking of, but Toronto and Montreal, they need to field a product that's worth watching like the rest of the league. That's where I did say, like, Montreal was an up-and-coming team. They had some young fans, young players or younger players that you could gravitate to. Vernon Adams Jr. was a fun guy to watch play quarterback, and they've got a good head coach who's a good orator in Kari Jones in Montreal. I did say when I went there, it did seem like it was more full than the season before. You look at Toronto, well, they were last in the league last year. And when you look at the two cities that we covered, what do we have to remember from the BC Lions? You know, fired their head coach after one season. Mike Riley had a terrible year. He broke his arm. All the issues on that field. What did they end up winning, Scott? 4 games that season? 5 games maybe in the end? Maybe even 3? And then you've got the Calgary Stampeders, which have a long history of success. I believe it's, what, 16 seasons now they've been in the playoffs or in around there? And I do think that leads to people wanting to go watch them play. If you can put a team on the field that's consistently year after year going to compete for the Grey Cup, I do think that goes a long way to, you actually don't really have to promote your product too much because the product on the field is really good.
You don't have to put any money in the fine jar because it's preseason. Earlier in the show, you went Michael Riley, and you just reverted, but we're learning now. We're learning.
That's sorry, Michael.
Okay. That's okay. He wants to be called Michael Riley. For anybody who missed that, we were having a little fun with that. We're hoping to have Michael Riley on this program a little bit later on this week. We'll see if it happens. David in North Burnaby. CFL teams have to pick the brains of the people who are running the Ottawa Red Blacks. They're getting the crucial millennials into their stadium. Find out what they're doing that you are not doing and do it. Anything you're doing that they're not, maybe consider not doing it anymore and advertise your product. It's a much bigger conversation. They revamped the stadium in Ottawa. They had been gone from that market for a very long time, had the Canadian Football League. When they went back in, they were also building up an entertainment district around the stadium. And that's the modern move with, be it football stadiums, hockey venues, whatever. If you're building a new arena, if you're building a new stadium, you put up infrastructure around it so that it's not dependent simply on your games. But also, when you have those games, and here's what happens in Ottawa. People go to that stadium a couple hours beforehand, and they go to the bunch of bars and restaurants right around that, and they have a pregame there, and then they walk into the stadium, and then when they're done, they walk right back out to those same restaurants and bars that are packed. And it's all right there in one compact area that doesn't exist in every single city. So part of it is a stadium conversation. I mentioned this earlier, Karen. One of the things they found in Ottawa is that they thought the millennials would have this negative perception of the CFL, because it hadn't been in their city up until that point in time. Never mind. Been there twice before. These people were young enough that they didn't have this negative perception of, oh, the CFL sucks. They'd never really thought about it. They were offered something new. They tried it. They liked it.
And I mean, when Ottawa came back into the city or back into the league back in 2014, I mean, they were terrible that year. They were 12-16. But look at what happened in the year after. They went to the Grey Cup. And the year after that, they finished first in the Eastern Conference. Sorry, they lost in the Grey Cup. They went to the Grey Cup in their second year. They won the Grey Cup in their third year. And then in their fourth year, they went back to the Grey Cup as well. It helps to have success with the team. They were 3-15 in 2019. Does that lead into anything happening this year? Probably not, just because they've been able to do it well. But I will point to, again, if there's success on the field, it sometimes just, it writes itself.
Someone texted in saying, as a 28-year-old, I would never go to a BC Lions game when I was in my early 20s. That's a long cause, says Ramon. I went back at Ramon and said, well, what about the Whitecaps? Because they came along, and for a number of years, that certainly isn't the case right now, and the team's playing out of market right now because of COVID this season. They had a much better atmosphere, and they had a more vibrant crowd, and you can't tell me that the vast majority of the people in there were super into soccer. But the perception was it's going to be fun. And that was the perception. Same building, a sport that they maybe cared about more, but probably not. They just knew that it was going to be fun, so they went. And that's where the CFL needs to go in these markets. Just convince people that it's going to be fun. Ramon replied and mentioned that the game is a lot shorter as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fair comment. You can't compare the NFL to the CFL because they're night and day. But you and I tell people this all the time. Like, when you actually go to an NFL game, the action you see on the field, it's just so different. It's, you don't realize the long stretches because when you're at home, you're checking your app for your fantasy football score. You're flipping over to another channel. You're running to the fridge. When you're at a game, you're actually surprised. Even though you know logically how many commercial breaks there are, you're surprised by how long it takes.
Yeah, the NFL is a bit, it's a made-for-TV event, and I understand there's fun going to it, there's a tailgating aspect of it, there's other aspects that go along with going to it, but honestly, like, I've been to four, Scott, just as a fan, not in a reporter's capacity like you have in the past, and I've walked away going, well, this was boring each time, because either the game on the field disappointed, I didn't have the ability to go watch another game on Sunday Ticket or just on cable, whatever it was, and I had to sit through, you know, a three-hour just snooze fest. So I'm not saying that can't translate somehow to the CFL, and I understand there's a lot of commercial breaks in the CFL, Scott, and it's a long product on the field at some points in time. You can be pushing 3.5 hours at some points, but I do just think that you just can't compare, and I will agree with you, you can't compare apples and oranges when it comes to the NFL and the CFL with what you're watching in the game and what you're watching on TV.
Very abbreviated version, but let's get it in nonetheless. Notes and quotes, better late than never. Let's go.
Who's in the top six?
Getting pucks out, getting pucks deep.
Who's in the crease?
Really none of your business.
And who's in the press box? It's time for notes and quotes.
3-year contract extension for Dominique Ducharme in Montreal would have been hard to justify anything other. Takes over mid-season. Canadians don't look very good under his watch during the regular season, but ultimately go to the Stanley Cup. Had to give him some type of reward for that. He was asked about his assistants, Luke Richardson, who had his stock rise, and Alex Burrows, who came onto his bench as well. Will they be back as assistants? Here's what he said.
I mean, that's something that Burge needs to finalize with them, but I don't see any changes with Luke and Alex. I want them to be back with us. We all, as a organization, they did a really good job, and so they should be back. That's just a matter of time for me. We like I said before, and we want to add one guy to our staff. When you look at when Claude and Kirk left, Alex came up, so we kind of work differently, being three guys instead of four, and we want to go back going four guys with a 82 game schedule and what we want to do and the way we want to work. And the other situation is Sean Burke, depending on, you know, Sean's going to be with us, but is he going to be daily, every day with us, or, you know, moving his family here, or he's going to keep working with the team, the organization from Arizona? Then from there, you know, we might have to look at the goalie coach in that situation.
You know what? You went to the Stanley Cup final. I understand that things are going to be very different next year. That division is very much different compared to what the North Division is when they go back to the regular alignment. But Alex Burrows, kind of a meteoric rise from when he was a player to where he is now, Scott. Luke Richardson took over. He's got the AHL experience. No coaching vacancies left in the NHL, so maybe expect him down the road to fill one of those. But it doesn't surprise me that Dominic Ducharme wants the guys back.
Elliot Friedman speculating that maybe Alex Burrows would run the bench with the Laval Rocket and get some head coaching experience as opposed to assistant. We'll wait and see, but he'll be retained within the organization at the very, very least. Just one game to quickly tee up. It's American League versus National League. It's the Midsummer Classic. It's Shohei Ohtani. He is the star of stars. He's going to start the game for the AL. He's going to hit leadoff. It should be a lot of fun tonight.
Yeah, probably watch the first couple innings and see how it goes. But like you said, there is absolutely nothing else on to watch, so my eyes may be averted to the All-Star game.
Four Toronto Blue Jays involved as well. There's that too, Karen. We will talk about what happens in that game tonight with Tim McAuliffe. Undoubtedly, at some point tomorrow, he will join us. Big ups to Greg Ballack back at Mission Control. Submitted his list and put a highlight up on Twitter for us to view as well. Jamie Dodd, our Shohei Ohtani, was fantastic again today, jumping on the air and producing the program. Karen, nice to reconnect here today for us, and we'll do it again tomorrow.
Sounds good. Have a wonderful rest of your day, everybody.
We'll turn things over to the big show in Calgary. It's Bick and the Boss in Vancouver. Enjoy your Tuesday. We'll talk tomorrow.